Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we are continuing our series on the Mormon concept of God today. I had teased last time that we were going to do the gendered God, a God with a body, because we didn't really get into it last time, and we're still planning to do that in this series. But a good listener by the name of David Gathro wrote, and he said, you know, Mormonism talks of Jesus and all that kind of stuff, but when we're thinking about concepts of God, I would really love to have a focus on our views and our theology of how Jesus Christ as a God or Jesus Christ functions in our views of the Godhead and things like this. And so I thought it was a terrific idea, and I got together some of my good friends who I think are really insightful on things like this to talk about it today. We've brought back Charlie Harrell to kind of help us, especially with the development of our ideas within Mormon thought through the early days. How did 19th century Christians, you know, think of atonement and the various terms, and when there's supposed to be something in the Book of Mormon that says this about Jesus Christ, would they have interpreted it any differently than we did now? And he can also help us through the different development through the lectures on faith and all the different twists and turns of our theological development about Jesus. And then I brought on good friends Jody Hansen and Phil McLemore, who I've just had so many good conversations with them in my life about Christ and about just theology and spirituality. And I think they both bring both wonderful things as Christians who also kind of understand wider framings and can kind of bring those things to bear as well. So thrilled to have you all. Charlie, would you just do the quick intro again? How many times you've been on the show? It has to be at least 10, 10 or 12. So we're probably going to get it down to 30 seconds these days, right?
But that's right.
Anyway, thanks if you would introduce yourself to everybody.
Okay. Again, I'm Charlie Harrell. I live in Orem, Utah. I teach at BYU in the School of Technology and also consult with a software company that I founded many years ago. And glad to be back on the podcast, and especially happy to be with Jody and Phil. Look forward to interacting with them in the podcast.
And give a plug for your book, or at least announce the title of your book again.
Okay, as another plug for the book, it is called This Is My Doctrine, The Development of Mormon Theology, and published by Coford Books. And it's a book that covers the doctrinal developments within Mormonism of most of the leading LDS doctrines, talks about how those doctrines were perceived in Old Testament, New Testament, early 19th century, early Mormonism, later Mormonism, and currently.
Perfect mix for what we're trying to do. So thank you so much. And it's, it is seriously the book that I consult more than any other book. And this is true for the last couple of years. So thank you so much. My typical habit is to go to the person who's been on the next number of times, and I'm pretty sure, Phil, you've beaten Jody by a few appearances. Would you quickly remind everybody a little bit about your background?
Oh, sure. I grew up Catholic, went to all male Catholic high school, joined the LDS Church at age 19, served a mission in Brazil. When I was working on my graduate degree, I started teaching institute at the University of Florida. I was later hired full-time as an institute director. I did that for about 9 years. I then left CES to serve as a military chaplain. I did that for a little over 20 years. And then I did about 8 years as a hospice chaplain, retiring about 2 years ago. somewhere in there, I began a serious practice of meditation. At first, to help manage chronic pain and the stress that comes from that. It later became the core of my personal spiritual practice. I've been really fortunate to be able to study with really world-renowned meditation masters. And so for the past, oh, I don't even know now, 10 years or so, I've spent a lot of time teaching meditation.
And you've launched something new that's kind of focused towards Mormons who want to kind of get interested in meditation and not have quite the high barrier with all the Eastern terminology. Is that a good way to phrase it?
Yeah, it's actually quite exciting that there are so many Latter-day Saints interested in more inner work and inner spiritual development. And I'm just to a point now where I see the core principles and practices of meditation in the teaching, symbols, mission, and ministry of Jesus. So it's really an easy thing to bridge that so Christians or Latter-day Saints can adopt a very rich meditation practice and still have it in an LDS or Christian context.
Awesome. Well, you do good work, brother, and you can send me a link or something if you'd like to. I'll put it on the website to what you're doing these days. Jody England Hansen, old friend. I know you and I did a big long interview, but I think it actually was for Mormon Stories. So this might be your first appearance on Mormon Matters, isn't it?
Yes, I don't recall doing one for Mormon Matters. I did the long one on Mormon Stories, and mostly the Sunday School and Exploring Sainthood podcast recently. But this is my first time on Mormon Matters.
Love having you. Tell us about your background.
Let's see. I live in Colorado now with my husband. He's Bishop of the Ward, so that gives me an unofficial calling. I teach 16 and 17-year-olds, and I love the new curriculum. I've got three children who are all grown, and within a week we'll all be living in Salt Lake. And I'm really pleased with how they're finding really unique ways to live their life, which is always constantly requiring that I give up what I thought they would be doing and appreciating what they are doing. And I have been doing a blog on living a created life called Living Creation. It's at creationconversation.blogspot.com. And then I'm working on another more faith journey blog called On Being Mormon and Human.
Ah, a title from your dad's writings. Tell everybody quickly that connection.
My father is Eugene England, and I actually started developing some things for the blog and came up with the title and then remembered his essay.
Oh, okay.
And so it's kind of interesting. I feel strongly that there are many things that have happened since he died 13 years ago that where he is having an impact. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's why I thought of it, even though I wasn't thinking of the essay at the time.
Yeah, it was one of the very last things. In fact, I'm not positive that we didn't publish it until after he died. So, it was something just kind of right there at the end. It was one of my first issues at Sunstone. We published that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, well, thank you. Is there anything else you wanted to share about your background?
Graduated from BYU. I'm an artist, a mixed media artist, and a writer. And I love combining language with visuals.
Awesome.
Right now, I'm creating prayer flags. So I make paintings on fabric, and then I write in a deconstructed alphabet. So the language is powerful to me, but then it becomes the person's own experience. So I love combining visual and language.
Nate, you have to show me some of that. I see you next.
Okay.
So thanks so much for being on. Well, let's just launch. I think this is going to flow really easily and whatnot. So Charlie, we're going to listen to you for a while, and we'll just ask our questions and prompt along or share a thing or two as you go. But if you don't mind taking us the lead through, I'm guessing a lot of this is going to come in from your chapter 8, some of the materials that you talked about in your book, but let's just let's talk about Jesus Christ in the among the early Latter-day Saints.
Okay, thank you, Dan. I would be interested to hear some of these other perspectives as we go along here, especially from more of a devotional point of view, because I think as we go through some of the doctrinal aspects, sometimes those can get a little bit dry and tedious, but I'll try to be sort of sketchy going through here so as to not get too bogged down in details. But I thought it would be interesting to begin with what the position of the church is today regarding Jesus Christ. And as everybody's aware, in January of 2000, in commemoration of the 2000th birthday of Christ, the First Presidency under Gordon B. Hinckley issued a declaration entitled The Living Christ. And in this declaration, they pretty much sum up what the LDS perception is of his identity, his divine mission. And two short excerpts from that that I think kind of inform this discussion that we're going to have here today. It states, "He was the great Jehovah of the Old Testament, the Messiah of the New. Under the direction of his Father, he was the creator of the earth. He was the firstborn of the Father, the only begotten Son in the flesh, the Redeemer of the world. He is the light, the life, and the hope of the world." So those are really kind of encapsulating, I think, the essence of the LDS view of Christ. And it doesn't get into a lot of the nuances of what it means to be, for example, the firstborn of the Father.
Right.
You know, what could that possibly mean? An evangelical or a Catholic reading that statement, or this statement that I just read, would probably not disagree with most of those aspects that are described of Christ, but they would probably have a little bit different understanding of what is meant by each of those. The statement, the declaration, goes on without any supporting evidence or amplification, saying, quote, "He taught the truths of eternity, the reality of our premortal existence." Now, interestingly, there's really no record of him actually explicitly teaching anything about preexistence. Quote, "The purpose of our life on earth," and again, I would interject here, he never really taught that we came to earth to obtain a body, to be tested, you know, kind of the modern LDS idea or notion of what we mean by why are we here. And then going on, it states, "and the potential for the sons and daughters of God in the life to come." And again, I would interject here that he never really taught that we are the spirit offspring of God, right, and have the potential to become like God in that absolute sense that we think of it today. So when I say that he never taught that, we don't have a record of that in the that is not the record of the New Testament.
Right.
So it is interesting that we tend to, and what this illustrates is that we tend to talk about Christ and our beliefs regarding Christ, they tend to be conditioned by our theology. And of course, from my point of view, our theology itself has changed over time, giving us a changing conception of Christ. So,
would you go as far as to say that maybe in some cases we impose LDS doctrine onto the teachings of Jesus?
Well, we certainly impose it onto the text in the of the New Testament. Whether or not we impose it on Jesus' teachings themselves, I'm not sure. You know, do we have his pure, unadulterated teachings? So I don't feel like we can make a judgment on that, but certainly the record that we have, the New Testament record, is not something that explicitly contains a lot of the specific teachings that we espouse today regarding Christ.
Yeah.
So as you're talking about the actual reference of Christ's teachings, I'd just like to specify, are you only referring to the New Testament then? Because it sounds like you're not considering the Book of Mormon accounts of Christ's teachings or the Doctrine and Covenants. So can we just clarify if that's what you're reading about that statement from the First Presidency?
Looking at the source of these teachings, when I say that we can't find these in the New Testament, that isn't to say that Christ never taught them, nor that they don't appear in other standard works that we have. Certainly, we have teachings on preexistence, the idea of the purpose of earth life, and so forth in modern-day Revelation. But the crucial thing for this particular proclamation or declaration is that these teachings are said to have been taught by Christ in his mortal ministry, with the assumption that they are recorded in the New Testament.
Yeah.
And clearly they are not.
Yeah, that's how I read it. It's right after the sentence of him walking and talking, you know, in that ancient time. Yeah. So I think that is the context. So I think you're right on there.
And part of the reason for reading this declaration is not to criticize the teachings of the church or our understanding of the New Testament, but simply to point out that it is characteristic of virtually all religions to, especially Christian religions, to read back into the New Testament, into biblical teachings, our current theology. And that's what we seem to be doing here.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, I'm glad you said that.
Okay, well, I'd like to move on to Christologies and how Mormon Christology fits in with traditional Christologies.
Okay, well, define that term first, and then just go crazy.
Okay, well, a Christology, of course, refers to one's view of Christ or the way that Christ is understood, particularly with respect to his divinity and humanity. So questions that naturally arise is, was he divine? Or was he human? Or was he partially divine and partially human? And a high Christology would be one in which Christ is viewed as being more divine than human, which would mean that a low Christology would be one in which Christ is seen as being more human than divine. So in the early beginnings of Christianity, there was not a single uniform Christology that was held by early Christians, but a variety of views were held, and part of establishing traditional Christianity was having debates and deliberating on which Christology seemed to make the most sense and that most people could buy into.
Now, by that, you're talking the 3rd or 4th century debates. Did Paul have a Christology? You know, when do you really even, do we even see much Christology in the scriptures themselves?
That's a good question. Scholars note that these Christological differences show up even in New Testament writings. And, of course, The earliest writings in the New Testament are the writings of Paul. And he seemed to view Christ as becoming God's son or deified through exaltation. Paul says nothing about Christ being God's son biologically or through a virgin birth or anything like that. And yet here he's testifying of Christ and of his divinity, but it's through his exaltation that he becomes deified.
Right.
Mark, which is the earliest gospel writing, which is, scholars believe probably occurred sometime after at least some of Paul's writings, view Christ as having been adopted as God's son through baptism. So when Christ was baptized, of course, the voice of the Father was heard to say, you know, thou art my son,
whom I'm well pleased.
I'm well pleased. Right. And almost with the idea, today, you have become my son. I have become your father through that event. And so many scholars see Mark as teaching an adoptionistic view of Christ, that he became God's son again through adoption. Later, that in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, which follow Mark, those are the only gospel writers that have Christ becoming God's son through a virgin birth. So all of a sudden we get the deification or the divine sonship of Christ moving now from the resurrection and exaltation, back to baptism, and here now it's moved back to his birth.
Yep.
Now the latest gospel that we have is the Gospel of John, and that's believed to teach the highest Christology, because that teaches that Christ was God, that he was divine from pre-existence.
So are you referring there to in the beginning was the Word?
Exactly. Okay. So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And Christ himself testified that he was before John, even though John he was trying to convey this idea that I am from above, you are from beneath.
The idea,
he was he had pre-existence. He had deification, some kinship with God from before all creation.
Yeah, and so when we get in eventually, I'm sure we're going to talk about Trinitarianism and all that stuff. They're mostly looking at John, right?
Yes, okay. Exactly. And right. Since that's the highest Christology, that's what Christianity latched onto.
Okay.
To say, here's what we believe about Christ. In the highest terms, he was God from all eternity. Now, what developed in the 3rd century is Origen started advocating a doctrine of eternal generation, that Christ proceeded from the Father and was not created. So when they read the passage in John about Christ being the only begotten of the Father, and for God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son into the world, that was viewed as being a divine sonship that Christ held prior to being born into this world. But because he was always God and part of God in the Trinitarian view, the idea was that he wasn't created, but he was eternally generated from God, whatever that could possibly mean.
Yeah, because if it's generated, you'd think there's a before and after. But, interesting.
Exactly, yeah. So,
well, I didn't mean to throw you into the scriptures, but I'm glad we did that, because you basically said there were a whole bunch of debates on Christology, and I knew that you were talking about Nicaea and all that stuff, but I'm good. I'm glad to see what the materials were that they were at least playing with, so thank you.
Yeah, and in fact, all of these debates, while we talk a lot about those early doctrines and creeds being shaped by Greek philosophy, it's important to recognize at the same time that Christians were trying to reconcile the idea of a monotheistic God with the claim in the New Testament, particularly in the Gospel of John, of Christ being God. And so the question was, well, how can there only be one God if Christ is also God? And so while we tend to dismiss in Mormonism Trinitarianism, I think we need to at least appreciate the fact that they were trying to grapple with reconciling that those two kind of ideas or beliefs that were somewhat in tension. So the view that they came up with in the Council of Nicaea, the view that won out, was that, of course, there were two basic views that were presented. Arius presented the idea of God having Christ having a beginning, and of course the doctrine that won out was that of the Son's eternal generation, which became then the pillar of the doctrine of the Trinity. So the next 1,500 years basically
we're debating.
it was continued to be debated, because there were Arians who were spread all over Europe, and Catholics were trying to convert them over to Trinitarianism, and there were wars fought over this difference in doctrine, as trivial as we might view it today.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, just kind of looking back to our scriptures thing, it seems like the later we go, the more effort to go more towards higher Christology. Because like you said, Paul isn't, at some point he is adopted. Mark, the next one, baptism. So we went from, at some point, maybe at his death or crucifixion. You can clarify that for me on when Paul thought it happened. But
Yeah, his resurrection.
That what it is? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we get Mark is moving it back. Matthew and Luke move it even to birth. And now John. And now, and then it sounds like by Nicaea and, you know, Trinitarian. And, you know, they're all trying to get that one God and Jesus is God. You know, it feels like it's more important to them the longer Christianity lives. Something like that?
Yeah, good observation. And it seems like that's where we get today to the idea that of Trinitarianism being such a strong movement or belief in most mainstream Christianity today, which holds Christ at a very high level.
Yeah, and that's why us Mormons, we're not Christian, because we're a little bit, we're not quite as high Christology.
Well, exactly. We like to think of ourselves as being very high Christology. I mean, certainly we're Christian because we not only believe in Christ and everything that's claimed in the New Testament, but we say we even have more about Christ that we know about his visit to America, etc.
Yeah.
But where mainstream Christianity rejects Mormons as Christians, where they do that at least, is largely based on this insistence that Christ is the eternal, uncreated Son of God, where we look at Christ as being at least having a beginning as a Son of God. And
so like
then,
the firstborn of the Spirit.
Yes, okay. Right, the firstborn okay. Son of God, and then growing and developing
yes.
to become like unto God. And this would be blasphemous to Trinitarians, Trinitarians who view Christ as God, eternal and uncreated as God.
Yeah, and then there's, of course, the level of body, and so much of Christianity, the early things, was the Gnostic idea of, you know, anything material is tainted and less than, and we get Plato, and we get all the Greek ideal of mind and, you know, spirit over body. So, yeah, that would be the other reason that they don't like us Mormons and want to call us Christians, right?
Was right,
that
right.
Fair? Okay, that's fair.
So there were a lot of Christianities. In fact, that's true. Not only Christologies, but Christianities, you could say in general, because people had different beliefs about how to exercise their faith and practice religion, their Christian faith, as well as different theological views regarding Christ.
Cool. Okay, so high Christology, low Christology, I think we have it. How much is he God? At what point did he become God? There are some terms out there that I remember from my old days at school, docetism or docetism, I don't remember how it's pronounced, modalism, stuff like that. I don't want to spend a ton of time there, but can you at least introduce stuff like that? Or is this the right point? Maybe I'm skipping
ahead. That would be appropriate. And I'll just touch on it briefly because I'd like to kind of move ahead to the time of Joseph Smith kind of prevailing beliefs at that time and how we inherited a certain Christology. But just to highlight again the fact that there were many views of Christ. There were the Docetics, who viewed Christ as entirely divine, and you referred to the Gnostics. That's basically their view. He was not at all human. He only appeared to be human. Then you have on the other extreme the Ebionites, who viewed Christ as entirely human and not at all divine. Though he might have been a good man, though he might have been adopted as God's son at some point in time, he was still a human. So here's a Christology where you have Christ as being entirely divine, not at all human, and Christ being entirely human and not at all divine. Trinitarian kind of split the path between the two. In adopting an incarnational view of Christ, claiming that Christ is both fully human and fully divine in a mystical, what theologians refer to as a hypostatic union. And this was not a mixture of divine and human substance, but it was a union in which you have two natures completely separate from each other. One completely divine, the other completely human. So this is an idea that we don't explore a lot in Mormonism, the two-natured view of Christ, and yet it does appear in the Book of Mormon, where it talks about, in Mosiah 15, about how Christ is both the Father and the Son,
right.
And that the will of the Son was swallowed up in the will of the Father part of him. In other words, you have almost two natures in this one person.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I want to do Book of Mormon separately, so I do have one question before we get there. Is this where modalism comes in? I've kind of heard some people talk about what we do find in the Book of Mormon, modalism. So if you define that for me, then I think we might be ready.
Okay, good. Another early perception of the Godhead or the Trinity was that, of course, it's difficult to envision for a lot of people the idea of how can you have three persons and yet only one being, the one being being God. And so an idea was developed that was called Sabellianism, and we typically refer to today as modalism, which is a belief. It's still Trinitarian. It's a variety of Trinitarianism that still says there are three in one God, but the three are not three persons, but rather three modes or manifestations of the one God. And you tend to see language that hints of this in the Book of Mormon when it talks about God being both the Father and the Son, again, in terms of you almost get confused as to, well, which person is he? Is he the
right.
Father? Is he the Son? And the Book of Mormon doesn't make real fine distinctions between persons of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost so much.
Yeah. And one more now, it just dawned on me. So I think we have modalism, different modes. We're considered, if we're anything, we're social Trinitarians. I mean, we of course call the Godhead and we never talk about Trinitarians, but what does social Trinitarianism mean as just a clarification at this point?
Social Trinitarianism is the belief in you have three different persons in a Godhead. So it is a little bit.
We didn't invent that.
No, we didn't. Okay. We didn't invent that. And there are some theologians today who hold to that view outside of Mormonism, in a way that says that kind of questions the concept of a single God manifest in three persons, and it makes a little more sense to a lot of people to call the three beings in the Godhead, one Godhead as opposed to one God.
Okay.
But it's still a form of Trinitarianism.
Okay. So why would ours not be a form of Trinitarianism?
Because we view them as being three gods, and gods in their own right. So ours is more of a tritheistic view of the Godhead rather than a Trinitarian view.
Yeah, good clarification. That's terrific. All right, that helps me. Now, I guess I still have more questions. One more thing is, social Trinitarianism or modalism? You're kind of saying modalism kind of sounds like the Book of Mormon here. Is there anything in these Messiah 15 that even hint at what we would claim today of the, you know, the three different beings? Or it really does sound like Joseph Smith is, you know, in his translation here, in whatever emerged from, you know, the process out of his mouth and onto the page, you know, kind of thing. Is there any sense that these were distinct beings? At least it's not in a Benedized section, right?
Right. And you do find references to them being separate individuals. But you also, in fact, obviously, you have occasions where Christ talks about his Father when he comes and visits the
Yeah, I was just going to say the visit's a little bit
right,
better. Yeah.
Right, and you have the experience of the Holy Ghost. So that's where most scholars, I think, who really take the Book of Mormon seriously and read it for what it's actually saying, trying to analyze what it's saying, will generally concede that the predominant view in the Book of Mormon is a Trinitarian view. So when you ask about Doesn't the Book of Mormon refer to three beings? Again, you know, to Trinitarians, it's not three beings that it's referring to, but it's three persons.
Yeah.
Three entities, but they're one God. And right. So the theme of the Book of Mormon and the expression that's used repeatedly is that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost are one God, not one Godhead.
Right.
You know, not one in purpose, but they are one God.
Yeah.
That is God. It's a Trinitarian God.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk later about the development of our view of the Godhead. You know, we'll get to the lectures on faith from the mid-1830s, you know, on through the 1838 account of the first vision and how that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, solidifies some more about separate beings and things like that. So at this point, I am thrilled with all this clarification. You know, I'll confess that even just as much as we've done with the different, you know, Christologies and things like that, it's just striking me how little this really matters, at least
Thank
to me.
You.
Yeah, because it's just a bunch of stuff that, I mean, are you having an experience of a change of heart? Are you doing a dive and you know, having you know, your soul light up because it now feels its worth? We'll do a the whole holy night, you know, the soul felt its worth. That to me is the whole experience of Christianity versus all this theological stuff. But mm-hmm. It is interesting and good that we've covered this. Is there more specifics we need to cover before we can kind of get into, like, did you want to do some passages that are really familiar to us and just kind of say, that's another one that we're reading into, that's another one we're reading into, or are we done enough with that to kind of begin to move a little bit more?
Well, I wonder how the King Follett discourse kind of falls in all of this about what we consider the early teachings, because that was radical, and yet it was never incorporated into canon.
That's a good question. In fact, a lot of people today, or at least increasingly, there tends to be some questioning of how much do we accept of the King Follett discourse. That same challenge of the King Follett discourse was evident early in the church as well. The followers of Joseph Smith, his successors, were a little reluctant to embrace all the teachings that came out of the King Follett discourse. And it was only over time that we began to embrace that and kind of accept it as gospel truth. It came from the mouth of our beloved prophet Joseph Smith, after all, so it must be true. So there is that question of how much do we accept of the King Follett discourse, but when you get into the whole notion of deification that we talked about in the podcast a little ways back, of course, that lends a whole truckload of support to the idea that there's nothing wrong with there being multiple gods.
Right.
That if we can become God, certainly Christ was a God. So
yeah,
we have that precedent.
Yeah.
Jody, did you have more specific questions about how does King Follett discourse fit within one of these Christological models, or you just wanted to mention it as another moment in somehow the evolution that kind of is playing out today?
Yes, I especially because I think about how I'm trying to remember where it falls in things. And since the King Follett discourse, the way I'm remembering, it was one of the last, I don't know, discourses of what comes across as revelatory doctrine or Joseph's interpretation of doctrine about our natures, God natures, how it all flows. And that, if I'm remembering correctly, there wasn't much that came after that before he died from him. And since it was such radical doctrine, I see so much about what happened during Joseph's life and his willingness to keep coming back to things, and then the interaction of so many and how things were recorded. It was a very it comes across as a very fluid thing to me. And again, as you pointed out, Dan, ultimately, what does it matter? But what's the overall message that we can turn to from what came from Joseph in the early days, and then what have we done with it?
Dead on. And Charlie, that feeds into my question. Are there other watershed moments, Charlie, that got us to where we are today? The one I know I want to talk about is when all of a sudden Jesus became Jehovah and the God of the Old Testament. But is there anything in between that sort of kind of marked an evolution in LDS thinking?
There are several titles that Christ has received we give an understanding of today that's different than what they were understood at the time that they were given.
Good. Let's hear.
One of them, for example, is Christ as the Creator. And in the book
Does that follow, though, from the Jehovah doctrine, or is this is early?
This is early. This goes back to the Book of Mormon times.
Okay.
In the New Testament, we read that it was Christ, rather than God the Father, who was the direct agent in the creation of all things. And Christ was the first in creation. One of the terms used in the New Testament refers to him as the firstborn, not because he was the first created necessarily, as Trinitarians at least would argue, but that all things proceeded forth from him. And so we read in John that without him, there was not anything made that was made. And so that's pretty universal, pretty absolute. And early Mormonism picks up that same concept, that all things that were created by Christ. And that includes humans. Now, we're talking about physical creation and spiritual creation, even. And it's only later that we start to separate Christ out of that role of creating humans. And so we make an exception. And so, especially later in the Nauvoo period, when Joseph Smith reportedly taught that Adam came here from another planet, an immortalized being, and started partaking the fruit and brought on himself death. And then, of course, Brigham Young, from Brigham Young onward, many church authorities taught that Adam was begotten, not created, that Adam and Eve came into the world the same way that everybody comes into the world. So then you have this idea of, well, what do we make of these early teachings about Christ being the creator of mankind? And there are explicit references to that in the Book of Mormon, in the Doctrine and Covenants. And so that was one of the motivations, again, for issuing this proclamation on Christ as the Father, that when it says that Christ was the creator of humans, the scriptures are invoking the doctrine of divine investiture of authority, right, where Christ is speaking as the Father. So it wasn't directly Christ. He's just... So we have this,
right.
You know, funny thing going on where, well, when is it Christ speaking as Christ, and when is he speaking as the Father?
Yeah.
And it gets a little confusing and muddled.
Totally.
So that's the case with Christ as the Creator, an idea that has changed over time. There's also a related notion of Christ being the exclusive agent in the creation of all things. And he kind of loses out some of his exclusivity in that role with the Book of Abraham coming along and later teachings in Mormonism where it's the gods being there and Abraham, you know, being one great and noble ones. And God said, let us, referring to all these great and noble ones, let's go down and create an earth whereon these may dwell. So, you know, what is the role of these others now in the creation, especially given that early teachings in Scripture, in the Book of Mormon, in those teachings, God merely spoke and the elements responded. So what is it like to create a world? Mm. So what we're seeing is, and the point I'm getting at, is that Christ's role is becoming diminished to some extent as Mormon theology begins to evolve, mature, and we start giving other people roles, and we start to understand how mankind came on the earth, and so we have to look for ways to reconcile these new ideas with these original foundational scriptures that give a far more expansive role to Christ.
Yeah, and that's something that we can do with our ninth article of faith and the commitment to continue in Revelation. But like, for instance, we mentioning the Council of the Gods and the gods let us go down. Did as you read the other people around this time of Joseph Smith, when the Book of Abraham starts to come out, were they like freaking out because this is such a totally radical thing, or are they noticing that this is a real shift?
That's a good question. You wonder. I don't know. I don't know of any accounts of people saying, "Well, wait a minute. It can't be this divine council that's doing the creation, because the scriptures say that Christ was the creator."
Right, right.
What many of them did, and the way Joseph Smith defended these teachings, was he said, "Well, you know, this isn't what it meant at all. Like the baru, or you know, the word for create." It didn't mean that create at all. It meant organize. And so he was convincing that that's how it should be understood. And so they probably saw it as further light and knowledge,
right,
not as a deviation in many instances.
Yeah, that's how I would have guessed, but I wasn't sure. So interesting.
But we don't have a lot of record of that, other than there were a lot of people who really... had a difficult time with the plurality of gods. We've moved away now from monotheism into some sort of polytheism, henotheism, whatever you want to call it, that's certainly a major shift. But getting back to Christ, some of the other titles that he had was the Son of God, the only begotten of the Father, the firstborn. And if you read those in the context in the Book of Mormon and early Revelations, it's interesting that while we think that a reference to Christ being the only begotten Son of God refers to him being the only begotten Son of God in the flesh, which is, in fact, Joseph Fielding Smith made the comment that Jesus, throughout his ministry, taught widely that he was the only begotten Son of God in the flesh. And yet, there is no teaching, no express or explicit statement or phrasing in any of the standard works, ancient or modern, that state that Christ was the only begotten Son of God in the flesh. And, you know, that has to at least make people curious as to why wouldn't it clarify that? Was it just implicitly understood that the scriptures mean in the flesh? But yet the predominant belief at the time of Joseph Smith was that Christ was the only begotten, meaning from eternity. He was that only one who proceeded from God from all time, from before the foundation of the world. He was the only begotten of the Father from the beginning. And God sent his only begotten Son into the world. Does that make sense? So he didn't become the only begotten Son by being born in the world, but he was the only begotten from eternity.
Right.
Now, that's just a different way of thinking about some of these terms that we just naturally assume today that it's referring to God, the Son of God in the flesh, but that wasn't necessarily how it was understood at the time. In fact, there's no teaching, recorded teaching of Joseph Smith ever referring to Christ being the Son of God in the flesh, or the only begotten Son of God in the flesh. That's an idea. In fact, the firstborn son, that's another idea that came later, because there was the idea of spirit birth, the doctrine of spirit birth, that only started to become apparent at the very tail end of Joseph Smith's life.
Right.
One more thing before we move off the topic of the only begotten Son of the Father as a title for Christ. I think it's interesting that throughout the Book of Mormon and even in the Book of Moses, there are references to the only begotten of the Father. And an example is in 2 Nephi 25:12, which says, "The only begotten of the Father shall manifest himself in the flesh." Alma 5:48 similarly states, "The only begotten of the Father, full of grace and mercy and truth, cometh to take away the sins of the world." And it's almost like the reference is to an individual who is the only begotten of the Father before he comes into the world. Nowhere in the Book of Mormon does it refer to Christ becoming the only begotten Son of God through being born of God in the flesh. And the point I want to bring up here is that...
Even in the vision when it says, "Behold a virgin," or "Behold his mother," there's no language about... There's nothing that specific in it in Nephi's vision?
It's "Behold the mother of the Son of God," you know, according to the flesh.
I just want to make sure that
begotten of the Father is... It seems to be a Trinitarian notion where, again, the prevailing belief about Christ at the time of Joseph Smith was that he was the only begotten Son from all eternity. The only begotten meaning nobody else was begotten fully spiritually, fully divine, the way that Christ was. Whether he was eternally generated that way or generated at some time prior to, you know, birth, at some point in time, it's still a pre-existent status that he held.
Okay, cool.
And I found it interesting that BYU professor Rodney Turner, those who may be old enough to remember him as a professor at BYU, an observation he made was that prior to his mortal advent, and I'm quoting from him now, "The only begotten is repeatedly referred to in the present tense in the Book of Mormon and in Moses." He goes on to say, "While it may be argued that this simply means that he was appointed to become so, I believe that the tenor of the relevant passages in both of these scriptures is that he was functioning as the only begotten from the beginning." And he goes on to explain the sense in which he was functioning as such, saying, "Jesus was the first and only spirit begotten into the Father's fullness in premortality." In other words, he was begotten as a divine Son in premortality. All others are spiritually begotten through the Son. Therefore, Jesus is the only begotten of the Father into the fullness of immortal glory.
So does that eliminate grace upon grace, line upon line for Christ?
Well, that's a good question, and that brings in another stage of Christ's existence in mortality, where he condescended. You know, that's a big part of the incarnation.
Yeah,
was that he put off? You know, it's the kenotic experience of
kenosis. Emptying.
Kenosis. Yes, the emptying to come here and become as man almost, and go through that stage of progression. So that's another aspect of his progression. But clearly in these early revelations, there's something going on here that I think we kind of gloss over today and just assume, oh, only begotten. Of course, he was the only begotten of the Father in the flesh. But there was that doesn't seem to be the sense in which it is used, and that's probably not how early saints understood it, because they were more attuned to the Trinitarian discourse of the time.
Interesting. And did I, something in Turner was, he's functioning as it, as the only begotten. Did he do anything more with that? I didn't quite, if you explained or picked up on that. yeah. language. No, I didn't know.
No, no, he didn't. And I think Turner is he's grasping at what that might mean. He recognizes that there's something about his status as the only begotten that designates him as being divine and partaking of the Father's fullness of his glory, unlike any other.
So is the functioning, but the functioning part is that means only he's uniquely qualified to do the atonement or something because of that status? How did he function in the world so differently than everybody else that this was the key?
Yeah. So he says he was functioning as the only begotten before being the only begotten in the flesh. And so as a divine entity creating, doing all the things that he did.
Got it. Even though the temple has Michael also helping, but yet probably, you know, there's a recognition that he's not fully God or anything. Right. Yeah. Okay, this reminded me of one other thing. We Mormons, because we have the idea of pre-existence and, you know, it gives us all this extra stuff to play with when we're thinking about only begotten. Any help on just this is just a quick one. Are we unique among others in really playing up this elder brother stuff?
One would think so, but other religions do. In fact, I've got a statement by a contemporary of Joseph Smith who referred to Christ as our elder brother, but they're referring to it in the New Testament concept of Christ as the firstborn among many brethren who are saved. In other words, firstborn is not first in order necessarily of birth, but it's also a position of prominence of you know, hierarchy. And so Christ is the most chosen, the most special, but he's the firstborn among many brethren who are saved. Who also embrace the gospel and are spiritually born again and saved. So to refer to Christ as our elder brother is in a completely different, they do it, but in a completely different context than Mormons do.
Yeah. Awesome. That's helpful.
Two things. How would you factor in the statement in the title page where it says Jesus is the Christ, the eternal God manifesting himself unto all nations?
Yeah, that is incarnationalism, right? That that's another, when we read Eternal Father in the Book of Mormon today, we read it thinking, oh yes, well of course, he's the Eternal Father of heaven and earth. So we've got this clarification from the 1916 Declaration of the First Presidency on the ways in which Christ is the Father, and one of them is because the saints were confused. And you know, so many references to Christ as the Father, what do they mean? And so the First Presidency under Joseph F. Smith issued this declaration, proclamation, stating that he's the Father in three ways, one of them being the Father of heaven and earth. So today, with our understanding that, well, yeah, Christ created the heavens and the earth, but he's not really the Father of our spirits and, you know, those other senses in which there is divine fatherhood.
It's interesting, as a military chaplain, I'm interacting with Catholic and Protestant ministers, and typically they're not comfortable with Mormons and trying to understand what it is we're teaching about Christ. But I had several conservative Protestant ministers say to me, I have no problem with the Book of Mormon. It sounds very like, much like what I teach and what I believe. It's all that other stuff you guys have added on.
Exactly.
The dilemma seems to be, we have a notion of the Godhead and of Christ in the Book of Mormon that in some ways is in that broader Trinitarian context, but reportedly these are people with the fullness of the gospel, but it seems like Joseph Smith's idea of the Godhead evolved to where toward the end of his life he's teaching something quite distinctive and quite different. So that seems to be a dilemma, that the notion of the Godhead in the Book of Mormon seems quite distinctive from what Joseph Smith ultimately began to teach, or what he ultimately ended up teaching.
But along these same lines, this is something that's kind of become a little more clear, especially with the Joseph Smith Papers Project. They're finding evidence that some of the teachings that Joseph Smith taught were changed before they were published, often by Sidney Rigdon. And so there's evidence in the actual papers as they're looking at these that Sidney Rigdon was bringing it back around more towards his background than along the lines of what Joseph Smith was trying to present. And the interesting thing is when you look at the descendants of those early church leaders, and we didn't have any descendants of Joseph Smith come west and become leaders in the church, but we did from Hiram Smith. And Hiram seemed to lean more along the lines of what Sidney Rigdon was saying than what Joseph Smith was saying. So again, we come back to really where was Joseph Smith's teaching leading us beyond what the Book of Mormon taught, or enriching what the Book of Mormon taught, and how much was still coming from other traditions and their interpretation of it, depending on which leader had the final hand in the recordings.
Yeah, it just seems that at the end of the day, Joseph Smith's notion of the Godhead seems to be quite different from the teaching of the Book of Mormon.
Right. And Charlie, is this the time to bring up the lectures on faith now that Jody has mentioned Sidney Rigdon? Because at that moment in time, he seemed to be deferring to Sidney. And yet I want to also play into how in the heck would you have the first vision, you know, and still be, you know, confused in this sort of way. So can you try, Charlie?
You do have a distinct evolution, development of the doctrine, where you get clear Trinitarian teachings early on in the church, in the Book of Mormon, in the Pearl of Great Price, in early sections of the Doctrine and Covenants. Then it develops into what some theologians would call binitarianism, which is a belief that there are two persons in the Godhead, not three. And that shows up in the lectures on faith, which teach that in the it actually asks explicitly, how many members are there, how many personages are there in the Godhead? And the answer is two. God the Father and Jesus Christ. Well, what about the Holy Ghost? The Holy Ghost is the mind of God that interpenetrates, interdwells the indwelling spirit of both the Father and the Son. And further in the lectures, it describes and depicts God the Father as being a personage of spirit.
Right.
Whereas only the Son is designated or described as a personage of tabernacle, meaning of flesh and bones. And then, of course, the Holy Ghost is simply the mind, this nebulous, all-pervasive mind of God. So did Joseph Smith write the lectures on faith? The evidence is that he didn't. There used to be a lot of belief that it was Sidney Rigdon that wrote them. More recently, there is belief that perhaps they weren't written completely by Sidney Rigdon, but that lecture number 5 in particular, which has the most to do with the Godhead, was possibly written by W.W. Phelps. That word print studies point to him as the author. So, but the point is, that is what was taught in the church. That is what was voted into the canon of the church, of the Doctrine and Covenants. So
yes.
Accepted as scripture.
Yeah.
So whether Joseph had a hand directly in it or not, he certainly consented to the teaching.
Do you sense that's because of just a lack of confidence on his own, or just the, you know, he hadn't inquired enough, or is it too speculative to say that?
That would be pretty speculative. My sense is that if he had any leaning towards more of the Godhead that we believe in today, I think he would have certainly stepped up. I mean, he was one for correcting doctrine, you know, and saying, you know, you've erred here. Here's the true way of believing or of seeing this idea. But he didn't do that with the lectures on faith. But yeah, okay, it could be that he just didn't feel comfortable with it. And as you mentioned, Dan, this is well after he had the first vision. What implication would that have had on his understanding of the Godhead?
Mm-hmm. Is not the first vision an example of our current understanding being imposed back onto the first vision? To my knowledge, for him, it was always a vision in which really anything could happen and not be doctrinally accurate.
Versus a visitation, is that what you're saying?
We have made it into a visitation.
Right.
As a matter of fact, in that 1976 film, Joseph Smith's first vision, the subtitle was The Visitation of the Father and the Son of the Prophet Joseph Smith. I was sitting with Bob Miller in the theater when we watched that, and both of our eyebrows flipped over the back of our head because... Yeah. That was like, whoa, when did it become a visitation, do you see?
Interesting. I don't know. That's in 76 that was the change. Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. Yeah, go ahead. It seems like we've imposed our current understanding onto the first vision.
Right, right.
What a crazy, weird, fun tradition that we have. We'll definitely need to do first vision, all that kind of stuff another time. For now, though, Charlie, any other titles that we ought to like quickly identify?
One last one that is kind of related back to the lectures on faith, which is Christ being in the express image of the Father, which is an expression that we view today. Of course, that's a quote from Hebrews 1:3, which describes Christ as the express image of God's person. And as Latter-day Saints, we often refer to that as evidence and proof that God the Father has a physical body. And yet in the lectures, we read that God has a spiritual body. So there are scriptures that were understood differently. It's another example of a scripture that was understood differently at the time of Joseph Smith, because there wasn't a notion that God had a physical body. So in the lectures, it states that Christ was in the express image and likeness of the Father in the sense that, quote, he was filled with the fullness of the mind of the Father, or in other words, the spirit of the Father, unquote. So it's interesting that it wasn't till later, I think it was 1842, when Joseph Smith, recounting his first vision of the Father and the Son in the spring of 1820, stated that they exactly resembled each other in features and likeness. So It's just interesting to me to see how phrases, expressions change in understanding and interpretation as one's theology changes over time.
Awesome. Two of you, What have any questions come up for you as we've gone this far?
Well, I appreciate how you're looking at this type of evolution of the theology. And to me, that's one of the most powerful things about our experience of Christ, is that we recognize that letting it be static or defining it in a I know this, and that's all I need to know, and all I ever need to know about who Christ is and what Christ is. There's a big difference, and that if we are open to recognizing that it can expand or change or shift, that's the only way to truly know and experience God, and to experience Christ in our Christianity.
Yeah, there's so much of a need, almost a human need, for certainty, finality, and yet it's stifling. It stunts our progress if we just, and President Nuckdorf gave a comment to this effect, that we do ourselves a disservice if we, and Dan, you remember the quote better than I do, you know, if we assume that we know it all.
Right, right. Just, Yep. How much revelation are we denying ourselves, basically, because we think we already have it all figured out?
Well, and the very nature of that is unChristlike.
Nice. Good point.
Yeah.
Final. Jesus is Jehovah. You know, in the statement, the Living Christ statement, they talk about Jesus is Jehovah, so I definitely want to visit this. So, are we unique among Christians in claiming that Jesus is Jehovah of the Old Testament? And then, my remembering from a book called Line Upon Line, which is a collection of essays, is that this was quite a late developing doctrine within Mormonism that now we're just kind of talking to it like, of course it's true, when it really didn't have that strong, revelatory kind of source. So take me through both of those angles, if you would.
Okay. In fact, the book that you referenced, there's an article in there by Boyd Kirkland that actually states that that title, Jehovah, being applied to Christ, wasn't something that was done uniquely until around 1885. So yes. We're talking about 55 years after the organization of the church. And yet today, as you point out, I mean, that's just how we understand Jehovah is that, well, of course that refers to Christ because that's what the church teaches today.
Yeah.
And so it's another good example of how an understanding that we have today of a title that Christ bears is imposed back on scriptural texts and even some of the teachings of the prophet where it doesn't really apply well.
Okay.
So
I agree, it doesn't. So that's fun to hear you say it doesn't apply well. Okay, so take us through it. Don't forget the part about are we unique among Christian faiths in this, and then let's do the complicated history of it.
Okay, I think that part of the thing that makes it a little bit difficult in comparing our view of Jehovah with a lot of other mainstream Christian views is the Trinitarian view of
it's all God, so yeah,
exactly.
We don't even need to worry about
Jehovah.
It, yeah.
It's Jehovah God, so when Jehovah is just a synonym for God to most other Christians. So it's not a name.
Name of an individual like we have. Right, yeah, we have right. Elohim and Jehovah, which also another complicated term, Elohim.
Exactly. So, Elohim is the same sort of thing. You know, in the Old Testament, that was just another synonym for God, basically. And yet we have used that or developed the idea that that is a proper name for God the Father. Jehovah is the proper name for Jesus Christ, and especially in his pre-mortal state that he was known as Jehovah.
Right. Okay. So I agree. That really wasn't as interesting a question to ask about where we are with others, because every manifestation of God is the same God. So, good. All right. But do take us through the history. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. But the point that you make with that for most Christians, that's a non-issue, that's where some of the confusion comes in to the Mormon, the LDS view of Jehovah, because in early Mormonism, it didn't make a difference either. It was a non-issue because Jehovah was used interchangeably with God, with Christ, frequently in the scriptures, in the early scriptures, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, and in the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. In fact, even later in his ministry, he started using Jehovah more and using it more in reference to God the Father than Jesus Christ even.
So he just wasn't worried about it. That just became a habit of his or something. In his brain, he wasn't even, thinking along these lines, right?
Yeah. It wasn't making a real distinction and seeing that, Jehovah is this person and so on.
Yeah. No, that's helpful.
It is interesting that in the dedicatory prayer of the, this is the Kirtland, no, this can't be the Kirtland Temple. This is the Nauvoo Temple. Well, I have in my notes that this is a prayer that he recorded in 1842, and I'm thinking, well, the Kirtland Temple was dedicated much earlier than that.
Yeah,
36. And
Nauvoo was pretty much later than that. How weird.
Yeah, Nauvoo was later. So I'm just, but you can find similar language. Joseph Smith refers to God as Jehovah in section 109, yes, in the dedicatory prayer of the Kirtland Temple. But in that prayer, okay, here's what he says. Holy Father, in the name of Jesus Christ, that's how he starts out. And then he pleads, continuing on, O Jehovah, have mercy on this people. So he's addressing Holy Father in the name of Jesus Christ and then pleading, O Jehovah, have mercy on this people. And that's in verse 34. And then in verse 42, he says, deliver thou, O Jehovah, we beseech thee, crying for pleas for help and against persecution and so forth. And so it seems like these petitions to Jehovah are directed to the Father. But it's interesting today in modern times how we reconcile this. At least one reconciliation was made by Bruce R. McConkie in conformity with the Christ as Jehovah paradigm. He explains that these petitions are actually, quote, accolades of praise, unquote, given to Christ and are cloaked in the language of prayer. So kind of an interesting way to spin that to try to maintain the consistency that, hey, if it's a reference to Jehovah, it's got to be a reference to Christ.
Which doesn't really fit because he's asking for forgiveness of sins, which we all sense is a father's thing, with the son pleading, you know, if anything, before the throne. Interesting. Yeah, that doesn't work.
Part of this also influences the confusion that we have about who we actually worship, right? I mean, do we worship Christ or do we worship God the Father?
You're blaspheming. We know we worship the Father. Yes. Come on.
and that is the position, by the way, of the church. There is an official church statement that we worship the Father in the name of Christ.
Right.
And we make that very clear today. But in early times, it certainly seems like there was this Trinitarian kind of idea and that God is God. And we don't make the fine distinctions about, are we praying to Jesus? Are we praying to God the Father? It's just, it's Jehovah. It's God. Mm-hmm. They are one. So yeah, that's just an example. There was that I was alluding to in 1842 as well, where he says in this one, O thou eternal, omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent Jehovah, God, that sitteth and saith the psalmist, enthroned in heaven, look down upon thy servant Joseph, etc. So here, Jehovah here was just another name for God. And Elohim, his names were used interchangeably.
Yeah.
So it was largely, again, this 1916 that we referred to before, this exposition by the First Presidency, Christ as the Father and the Son, that really solidified and made official through this First Presidency statement, declaration, that Jehovah is Jesus Christ.
And okay, how did we get there and why in the heck would we go there?
Okay, and it comes back to this confusion again about who is being referred to. Who when they talk about Jehovah in the scriptures and they talk about Christ as the Father, what does that mean? How can Christ be the Father? And who is Jehovah? How come Christ is referred to as Jehovah sometimes and God the Father at other times, it seems like, at least? And of course we're making these kinds of distinctions from this more tritheistic or even less harsh, a social Trinitarian kind of perspective, right? Where we feel like we have to make these definitive distinctions between each member of the Godhead.
Okay, so this would be post Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith obviously didn't, this wasn't stuff he was worried about. So you're basically saying the Utah period when people are really starting to study and say, what the heck?
Yeah, and it is interesting that this teaching of Jehovah, about Jehovah, follows the death of Orson Pratt and Brigham Young, who were kind of holding on to a theological legacy. And then you had people who started to come along, like James E. Talmadge and others, and B.H. Roberts, that started really digging into the scriptures and the texts,
trying to sort out the seeming inconsistencies. And so this was a great period of theological solidification definition during that early turn of the 20th century.
Okay. By mentioning Brigham Young's death, that actually took care of a question I had, which was, because in the Adam-God doctrine, which Brigham was a proponent of, we have Jehovah being the God of this world and Elohim being like grandpa. Well, no, it was Adam being the God of this world, Jehovah being his father, and Elohim being the father after that. So we did get a sense of a difference in Brigham Young between Jehovah and Elohim. So there's that going on, but that really wouldn't have been really a factor in Jehovah as the God of the Old Testament.
Yeah, not so much, right?
Okay, thanks.
So that's how we got to where we are today.
It's never in a revelation where this. So you said 1916. You know, you kind of get the official statement, but you kind of mentioned in 1895. Did you say
1885 was the first time that Jehovah was used uniquely as a designator for Christ? It's an 1885 sermon by Franklin D. Richards, in which he states that Jesus's name, when he was a spiritual being during the first half of the existence of the earth, before he was made flesh and blood, was Jehovah. So here he comes out and expressly states that Jesus' name was Jehovah in the Old Testament. And so the expression started to appear early in 1885, which is not very early in church history, but it wasn't solidified again until the 1916 exposition.
Okay, so that was Franklin D. Richards, but somehow in my memory, wasn't it George Q. Cannon was involved with all of it? Let's just declare this, or do you remember?
Yeah,
more
George Q. Cannon was involved in it. Trying to think, have to look at some further notes to actually flesh that out. I don't have that.
But it was never a prophetic thing. It was never in a revelation. And so by 1916, it would have just been one of those things for the last 20 years that was just getting more and more frequent. And they probably didn't ponder it fresh. Something like that, maybe, for the 1916 statement. So just another one of those things that kind of got in here. I don't see how it solves any of the problems, frankly, and it creates the other one, which is, you know, Jesus Christ, is who we see in the New Testament, is so different than supposedly the premortal Jehovah. How do you – I have my own takes on, you know, how that could work out. They're probably leftovers from my days of trying to make it all fit, you know. these things have to be true, so I've got to reconcile it myself. So I've got some thoughts, but what about you? Do you like the teaching? And maybe you don't even want to say that so much as does it help clarify anything for you?
One interesting thing that comes to mind before responding to that directly is, it is interesting that you have the God of the Old Testament, Jehovah, and if we think that that is Christ, it's interesting that in the New Testament, there's repeated reference to that Jesus makes of the God of the Old Testament, that is his God and our God and Father, that we should worship. And you wonder, well, now why would he be referring to the God of the Old Testament as his father if he was the God of the Old Testament?
Yeah.
So you have it doesn't make sense. It gets messy. It gets confusing.
Yeah, let alone the character difference between
the
two.
And then the character difference is an interesting one. And, you know, you have to believe that the character of God reflected a lot of the culture, don't you think, where there were these tribal wars and conflicts in the Old Testament, and God was a God of war and, you know, set his bow in the sky, all the things that kind of point out to, and the commands that he gave the Israelites to go in and destroy. And, of course, is that the question you're asking is, are we comfortable? Does that sit well with the New Testament teaching about Christ and his teaching of forgiveness and so on, and compassion? And it just seems like it is a different deity altogether.
Yeah. And I guess my old way of doing it. Now I just don't even worry about it. But my old way of wrestling with that would just be, well, when your child is growing up, you have to be stricter with them. You have to be lot less, you know, it's almost like the school marm. You know, you've got to be constantly on them because they're stepping out of line left and right. And when you had a conquered people that had been in slavery for so long, this is the way you would act, you know, in order to kind of get their attention because they're so easily distracted because they really haven't had their own integrity or their own chance for self-determination for so long. So, you know, that worked for me probably for a while, and now I just tend to reject this particular identification and not worry about it. And then I'll tell you, even just doing the series that I'm doing this year with David Bakavoy and Brian Howlid and Father Tom, and we've been getting into Genesis, and, you know, you have the Yahweh character in the J document, you know, versus Elohim as God in the E and the P document. And when you just start, you know, looking at Yahweh, which is what we consider, you know, these Greek letter or these Hebrew letters that, you know, kind of create the word Jehovah.
Right.
The Jehovah God is the Yahweh God is kind of the really immature God. It's like this guy is he's the one that wants humans just to keep a nice garden for him and send up the nice smoke sacrifices because he enjoys it, and he gets mad when we get uppity and he just destroy us, and it's just like, man, Yahweh as a God, it just doesn't work for me. Period. He's an interesting character. I loved, you know, Harold Bloom's Book of Jay and, you know, kind of some of the fun stuff that he does with the Yahweh God. But, it certainly doesn't seem consistent as somebody that I would, you know, want to look at as a God figure. Whereas I'm comfortable with Christ as a God, you know, and I love... it's the only one that's worthy of worship. You know, it's the only one that's really, you know, and I like Lowell Bunyan's statement to somewhere along in one of his books. It's like, you know, whenever there's these competing, you know, versions, he goes, I feel no compulsion to assign any, you know, quality to God that I haven't seen or met within the character of Jesus Christ, you know, within the New Testament or however he phrases it. And that's just where I've settled as well. So.
Yeah, I think that's one of the greatest values of the podcast that you've been doing with David Bakavoy and the gang is that it really brings to light, you know, the cultural influence, really, I think, on a lot of the theological discourse that took place in the Old Testament, and that we need to recognize that isn't necessarily who God is. That's who God was conceived as being to a lot of different people, and it varied from group to group, tribe to tribe, writer to writer.
Right, and they also described God to suit their own purposes for whatever the political situation was as well. You know, there's lots of stuff going on. So, yeah, we're going to continue that series, listeners. I know we haven't done one in a while, but we're trying to get everybody's schedule together. So hang on for more Genesis soon.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.